just beginning to get the feel of how to make it all fit together. I'm often very discombobulated on the third day. If you are, it's okay. It's just what happens. I've been thinking, or just feeling really, every time I come into the Kaisando, about all the teachers. They're all up there. All of our ancestors, our American ancestors, and the ones who came from Japan to be in America with us. And I'm more and more touched by that. I knew almost all of them. Maybe I knew all of them. I did on the altar. Ik and Roshi and Darlene and Suzuki Roshi, Mizumi Roshi, Katagiri Roshi, Koban Roshi. They were all ordinary people. And in some cases, they were kind of irresponsible and difficult, just as their personality was like that. And sometimes people were quite shocked that a teacher would be like an ordinary person. It's like when I was children, we used to tease each other and say, well, yeah, but the Queen of England shits too. That was a great joke. And yet they were all way beyond ordinary people, each one of them. And that's what's so interesting, of course. And it isn't that they were splendid in any way. They were not splendid people. I mean, imagine Darlene with her bright skirts and her lipstick and her red toenails. she was spectacular. And there was no stopping her. And then the very modest ones like Ik and Roshi, with a little sense of humor to go along with it. Was delightful. And they all had very hard lives. It is such a hard job. And each of them had very large groups of people and were trying to serve and establish temples and stay in touch with Japan. The politics of it was still is very complicated. And trying to start something up from scratch is very complicated. And that they manage that is remarkable. And of course, the way it works is that several people were attracted to something and wanted to help. And little by little, other people were attracted. And then when the space was available, people could come and sit and begin to experience the flavor of it, you could say. And then begin to pitch in. Because one person can't do it all by herself. Nobody ever has. But the thing that brings people to a teacher is not his life, is not his character. Originally, I'm sure we all projected on our teachers big time all kinds of things. And that's something to get over with, or you can't really take in the teaching. So that when we Koban offered an opportunity to meet in a social way and was very kind and very generous and cooked for us and made little parties for us. But when we met him in the Dokusan room, it was something else. Something else going on. So it takes... I read somewhere that there's the... Well, Dogen says it in the beginning of the Genjo Koan, but I... Yeah. The Buddha side and the ordinary side, you could say. And yet, at the end, there's no side. We stand in the middle of nothing. Neither that nor this. Just a piece of the whole thing. And so our teachers brought us a view through her eyes, through her gestures, through her voice, and through the deep silence that comes with practice. And each one of us receives that and is that. So in terms of practice, a student and teacher are the same. We could say sometimes student, sometimes teacher. But I must say, I didn't start really learning the Dharma until I had to sit in this seat. Then you really have to work hard in order to be true to people. This is such a scary kind of position, really. You don't want to screw up. And yet, it's a wonder. It's just so wonderful to be able to meet one by one Buddha, you could say, and Dharma in the guise of Sangha. And that's what we're all doing here as we meet each other. Meeting each other in terms of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. We don't really need a teacher. You can't teach the Dharma. The Dharma is way beyond words. It's in each one of us. But the teacher can provide a safe place and insight from having experience and confirmation for those who are willing to share their life and express the wholeness of themselves. So as students, we all have a continuous job of studying the Dharma, meaning studying the self, meaning adhering to the precepts, especially. It still surprises me how some people in authority in Zen, how can I say this? Sort of clip edges off the precepts, that there is some lack of clarity in what the precepts actually say, so that in order to keep a large temple, for instance, going, it's very, very hard not to have to cut corners and compromise because it's a business. And that's true of Jikoji too. Jikoji is a business. And it, as always, is struggling. And I think struggling quite a lot right now. And so it's very easy to take the precepts and assume the precepts in one's life, and yet the basic precept of doing no harm to living beings, embracing and sustaining all beings, embracing and sustaining them, not just pushing them around and telling them what to do, but taking them in, including their pain and suffering, which is your pain and suffering too. Embracing and sustaining right conduct. That's the precepts. Embracing and sustaining every good without compromise. I think our presence in nature is one of the things that can help us to realize the largeness of us. And the ethical status of the world as it's live. The trees are growing with a tremendous energy that we could call love. Everything is coming up out of the ground with intention. The intention to grow, to be, to express what it is. And so it seems to me that we can be inspired by that and also offer that to create places where people are free to come and feel safe, free to feel their growing, the life in them, the being, the mysterious being. We don't really know what we are. We'll never know really what we are. Could say we're just little pipsqueaks running around on earth, you know, like a woodlouse or something. But we are. Coben used to say, "I'm just an idiot," and boy, he was. There were times. Sorry, Balin. It's true. But it can't be helped. Here we are. This is what we get. And our job is to take care of it in the best way, not for ourselves only, but for everyone. We're here for everyone, not just for me. I was invited to go to a gathering, the first gathering in San Jose, of a homeless and all the religious leaders in San Jose. There were Jains and Sufis. There were several different kinds of Buddhists. There were, you would be utterly surprised at how many Christians and Buddhists and Hindus. And everybody was there. And some homeless people also. And they had provided a list of all the people who had died homeless during the year. And we did a memorial service for them. And most of the people there, or a great many of them, were working for and with the homeless. And all of us, I think, had a very strong understanding of what a deep, big problem it is. I think that kind of experience and that kind of knowledge is really important for us to keep that in mind, rather than when the next time we go to Starbucks, or all of the things that we decide and do to keep ourselves amused and distracted from the suffering in the world. I used to feel terrible when people would come who are doing that work, and I would think, oh, you know what? I'm not doing anything like that. And then I finally realized that I hope I'm trying to create some kind of space where people can find the way to release themselves and reach out. It's not as fine an effort as going out on the street, but I feel it's the best I can do. So that's my talk. Are there questions? Rob?
I'm a little confused about when you talk about how I think you were saying, particularly around how organizations can muddle the precepts.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of my words, not yours. But mm-hmm. So I'm a little confused about that. And does that... Is that a sort of a prone to a sort of a collective kind of thing, or are you thinking more like individuals? Or?
It's both. Each organization has a culture, and the culture is defined by the people in it. And so if you get reprehensible people in, then you're going to have a reprehensible culture. So we have an effect on each other that way, in the large. And of course, it's in the small as well, individually. And the larger the institution, the harder it is to keep everything together. And the more people it takes just to run things. And running things, you don't have time to sit very much. And you don't have time to study Dharma very much. You're out there, you know, calling the septic tank man, or doing the insurance, or trying to balance the books. It's very serious business to keep a temple going. It's not a joke. So I've always thought about Jikoji that small is the only way for it to happen at all. Is to keep the size of the Sangha. And just remember that all beings are members of our Sangha, so it's not an exclusive place at all, but just to keep Jikoji as a place for people to come a little at a time and experience this. And then and be held by it while they're here. Be held by the ones who are willing to be caretakers here. So, does that make sense?
I guess I'm trying to see it in through my experience of working with groups where there's this phenomenon that happens at meetings where you develop, you know, there's a lot of good ideas, and that may even get to the point where you develop policy. But then that all seems to kind of get lost, and that frustrates people. So then they want to sort of codify it and enforce it, and then they kind of lose the whole intent in the first place. And so that's how I was kind of understand. I don't know if that's what you were saying, but that's how I understood it.
Mm-hmm. That's what happens. And so it's very helpful to have someone with great integrity to lead, and that doesn't always happen. And you pray for someone to come or some people to come and help with real integrity and keep the thing together. Institution means structure. So once you get an institutionalized situation, then you're bound to have situations like that. And it's always been my koan, how do you keep the Dharma alive in an institution? How can we do this? It's not easy. Dennis?
Rob made me think of my own career, and if I can use some of the vernacular from that time, one of the real challenges for us, my colleagues, bosses, everyone, I think, all the people, all the humans, was it's a real tough, not a juggling act, but, a scale to find a balance between the letter of the law and the spirit of the law.
Yes, that's exactly the thing, the spirit of it. And that's what gets lost. How do we keep the spirit of it alive? That's the crucial thing. And it's so easy to lose. Because, why?
You're asking me why?
Yes.
Well, I guess the facile answer is politics that get involved. People's desire for making a name for themselves, promotion, attaining position of authority that they're not really equipped for. You hear the line staff talking about the Peter Principle all the time. That's my boss. One step too many. So I don't know if that...
Well, you could really call it self-clinging.
Mm. Yes.
It's greed.
Absolutely.
To practice, must be rid of self-clinging.
And boy, do good bosses ever stand out like a thumb that doesn't hurt.
Well, and that's what makes them a good boss, they say. Now there's some writing going on among thinkers about how maybe this isn't such a good way, that maybe the rapacious boss who is making all the money for the stock market aren't such a good idea. They aren't doing such a good job after all. It's very interesting. So it's changing a little bit, but basically it's self-interest. As long as we put ourselves first, and often in an institutional organization, if we don't put ourselves first, we tend to get trampled or put in a corner or disrespected.
My wife and I talked about this because we were colleagues and we met and fell in love at work, and she maintains that you've got to take it on a case-by-case basis, but in too many instances to suit her, people who aspire to positions of power and authority, and politicians are always her prime example, have something in their personality that's a little bit off to begin with. She calls them sociopaths. But she says, it's like you were talking about communication and electronic devices. You're not going to beat the horse again, but you pointed out the utility. There's mm-hmm. clearly some really awesome stuff, you know. So there are some, you know, great people in positions of power, but I think she touched on something. She touches on something when she says that. Mm-hmm. Something you have to be wary of, people that really want to be able to
absolutely
have that position.
That's true in the Zen world too. Somebody wants to be ordained. Somebody wants to have a particular position. That's not the Dharma. That's not practice. It comes from deep inside. It has nothing to do with wanting at all. It's choiceless. Chris?
Well, I was just thinking about the job I retired from in a nonprofit world where they're doing so many incredible things, and the woman at the top of that arena was really a powerhouse and really had such philanthropic ideas. And I think she cared in a way that calcified, in a way, I think it calcified her, and she got tired, and then she got more and more autocratic, and she gathered people around her that, you know, were really calcified along with her. And my God, it was incredible how she could do so much good with her organization and all of us that were involved in it, and be so hard on the people that she had working under her.
Mm.
It was really such a disconnect. So it's, I mean, even in a, like we were talking, even
yeah.
in a you know, spiritual organization or a very philanthropic, that power, that need to hold on to it, whatever form it takes, like, it's not going to work if I don't hang on to this. And then it just gets, not to mince words, they become psychopathic,
mm-hmm.
you know, in a way.
Mm-hmm.
That's their idea is so fiercely
fixed. Fixed, yeah. Excellent point. And then everybody is suffering in the middle of it. I mean, nobody's happy or satisfied, or it's just a job.
Well, in this organization, everybody was doing their own work in the community. At least that's where I got my satisfaction from that job, was kind of distancing myself from the kind of energy that was coming from the top.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of what you have to do, but it feels really, when you're caught in something like that, you just have to make the best of it. And that's happened over and over, you know, in the corporate world. I don't mean to rattle on and on, but the guys that made it to the top were the ones that were the most fierce about
mm-hmm.
the need to be on top.
Mm-hmm.
Not their quality of work or their way of cooperating with others. Good to be retired.
Well, you're doing a lot more work now than you did then. And enjoying it more. Bree?
So as someone who's not retired, that's one of the things I really struggle with. Day to day, I notice you know, just the process of, usually it's sort of receiving emails or not receiving emails, or if Joe has listened to me for, you know, a long time on this, because it still has the same effect when someone says, I'll get back to you on Monday, and then they don't, or there's this, you've had a meeting, or you've had two meetings. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And what is said is not what happens, or the intentions that are spoken are different than what rolls out, and there's not even a communication about, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
You can say, well, the course has changed trajectory. There's not even that, you know? And I don't know if it's because, like, I grew up in this family with parents that integrity was really big, for them, and so, and they were always there, you know, and at all the events, and maybe that wasn't a very good reflection of what the world would bring me when I'm, you know, a struggling, aspiring entrepreneur.
Yes.
But I really struggle with when that lack of integrity, what seems to me to be a lack of integrity, when I have to face that, you know, over and over and over and continuously open, and, you know, I don't know if it's just like I'm just not cut out to be an entrepreneur because
mm-hmm.
that is that world, it seems, you know, or, you know, if I'm supposed to just open to it and embrace it and have compassion for the people that were so busy that they couldn't get back to me,
mm-hmm.
you know, and or whatever, something happened with their dog, you know, who knows what's happening for other people. But, and maybe it's all based in this, like, idea that the world needs to, like, revolve around me and my needs, and I'm, like, struggling to become self-sufficient, you know? I don't know, but I appreciate your reflections.
Oh, I understand completely. You know, people give weddings and send out invitations and spend thousands of dollars and nobody replies. They give parties and nobody says they're coming. Nobody knows how much food to make because nobody will tell them. It's what's happening now. People just don't respond to each other in the same way that they did when I was growing up. My goodness, we still wore white gloves. And we would always respond, no matter what. So, what I have always tried to do is to know a few dependable people who can help me. You can't do it all by yourself. It's just too hard. But with other people to help you and encourage you and do some of the job,
mm-hmm.
that helps a lot. And maybe just, oh, I know it's hard. It's the money thing and all of that. It's really tough. But that's my suggestion, basically. And keep the spirit of integrity. Keep the spirit. It's needed. Let us know how it goes.
I will. Well, I mean, I have had some success with forwarding those emails to Joe and just saying, what do I say to this? So he's, you know, holding a lot of it for me. That's helpful.
Yeah.
You made a comment, Angie, about not studying enough, or studying the Dharma, not studying enough the, you know, the Dharma, but nor meditating, something like that, in the spiritual organization or something. Something about,
I was saying the leaders of organizations often get involved, so involved in the operation that they lose the sense of practice.
I was thinking of one of my very first teachers, student of Joko Beck, Elihu Chinimo.
Yes.
And
yes.
He was my first teacher, really, that besides Steve and you, who's, you know, basically said, just, you know, the most important thing is meditate. You know, reading lectures, that's like cherry on the icing on the cake. Just, it's the med. So I, you know, with my poor time management, I at least try to, you know, think the meditation first rather than like take a class in paramitas or something.
Oh, absolutely.
That's my question to you. Do you?
That's a good question. So, it depends on what your intention is in your life, which way you're headed. And if you're practicing Zazen, that's the only thing you need to do. But sometimes you get interested in more, in where this came from, how it developed, who our ancestors were, and how we came to this place. because we're sitting on the shoulders of hundreds and hundreds of men and women who did this practice and shared it. So there's nothing that says we have to read anything, but there are often times when we want to. And that's very helpful, especially if we're going to try to talk about it. Talking about it requires real study. Otherwise, sometimes it's helpful, sometimes it just misleads you too. So books are, they're wonderful. And we're getting so many wonderful translations now. It's just gorgeous. But not to take that too seriously.
Well, I appreciate you doing all the transforming of Kogan's speeches in that little book.
Yes.
Julie Cosworth, I guess, printed.
Yes.
I agree, it's fun to go and read a fun and supportive and helpful.
Right.
I just find it difficult at times to, you know, find the time at night to be in with a Sangha group, and though they're wonderful offerings, but I guess if it's a choice of energy for me, I prefer to focus on trying to sit.
It's a choice of you. Yeah. Yeah. Dylan.
Yeah, I'm curious how you teach students to work with the precepts. Seems like there's, like, I've been reading about them a lot lately. And there seems to be three ideas. One, that we should bring our behavior in line with the precepts and work from there. There's another one that we should just sit Zazen and learn the Dharma, then the precepts will arise naturally. And there seems to be a third idea that if we really get the precepts, then we learn that our behavior is already in line.
It's we're already enlightened, so we don't have to be good anymore.
Right. Sheldon Krumpa.
Yeah. But in the meantime,
how do we get our hands on the precepts?
Well, the way we teach it is in floating Zendo, to take one at a time and just take it home and live it and see how it shows up in our own life. What we often think that we're pretty perfect and we don't do those things, you know. We don't steal. We don't lie. I've never told a lie. You're sure of it. And then you, if you're really thinking about it, this is studying the self. Pops up, there it is, and you're doing it. Nobody else is doing it. You can't blame it on anybody. And I think that's the most helpful. That and the Bodhidharma precepts after that, after studying prohibitory precepts, to go to the Bodhisattva ones.
Okay.
They're also, that's the absolute side.
Yeah.
No, there is no killing life. But you can't say that until you've taken the prohibitory ones.
Bad first, good second.
Yeah. Something like that.
Or no and then yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
But we don't say no. We just, well, we say no killing life. We don't say I will not kill life. Because that's a ridiculous thing. It's not true. But we can say no killing life as our vow and leave it open that way. Well, that's a good way to stop. It's 4:00. Thank you all. Being our number.